Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Michael Leader.
I'm Pamela Hutchinson.
And I'm Rogan Graham.
On the show today, the Queen of Soul gets the biopic treatment in the Aretha Franklin flick Respect. We have the Berlin Film Festival drama Co-Pilot. And in Film Club, we're going back to the 60s for Joseph Losey's subversive drama The Servant. Plus, David Jenkins beams in to share his highlights from the Venice Film Festival. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, welcome back, listeners. Welcome back, Pamela, Rogan. Rogan, how have you been? Has your life been changed since Space Jam 2?
Do you know what? It's only gone up since Space Jam 2. Everything has improved significantly. no, I've been well. I have a slight cold, so if you can hear that, apologies, but I've been very well.
Good. I hope that cold clears up soon. Pamela, it's been a while since you've been on the show. Since we've revamped it earlier in the year, we'd like to reintroduce our guests. So, Pamela, who are you? What do you do?
Who am I and what do I do? I've no idea. I'm a freelance writer, film critic, do a bit of film history. I'm often found talking about silent cinema, but I'm going to try not to do that today because I don't think that's relevant.
Yes, of course. What I love is whenever I speak with you, and you know, most of our colleagues are off to Venice or Toronto or Cannes, you're often going to another festival completely. So everyone was jetting off to Venice and you were going completely elsewhere in Europe, I believe, right?
Yeah, I just got back from Indie Lisboa, where one of the things that I was really excited to see was the Sarah Mulder retrospective, which was incredibly in-depth and fantastic. And I wrote a little piece for Little White Lies about that. Of the new films I saw, I really enjoyed the new Alice Diop documentary, New, which is lots of snippets of Parisian suburban life and a very personal film. But yeah, normally I'm going somewhere where there's no dialogue, but this time I made an exception.
Terrific. Can't wait to read that piece. But speaking of film festivals, David Jenkins has literally just returned from Venice, so I grabbed him for 10-15 minutes to ask about his highlights, and let's have a listen to those right now. David Jenkins, welcome back. How was Venice?
It was delightful, thank you. Very warm. I got covered in mosquito bites. I'm more bite than man now, but yeah, I'm back. I'm full of Aperol spritz and just going to spend the next sort of week detoxing.
What's the staple diet out in Venice? Is that a gelato place? Were you eating lots of pizza? What was going on?
Oh, God, it was pizza and pasta, relentless. I mean, there is no real other options, to be honest. Yeah, it's all about kind of in between films, grabbing what you can. And they had sort of the only thing they had that was fairly quick turnaround was pizza. Mm-hmm. So by about the third or fourth day, I was a kind of carb blob rolling around the place.
Yeah, but I suppose, yeah, quick turnaround between screenings is what you want at a festival. From afar, it seemed like a really great year. For that first week or so, everyone was giving 5 stars out like it was no tomorrow.
It really was. They were making those 5 stars rain, really, wasn't it?
But how is it for you? Do you want to talk through some of your highlights?
Yeah, no, it was a really nice festival. It was a weird one because it was a sort of the first big COVID Venice after last year, which was a kind of smaller affair. Still had a sort of fair number of press last year, but from what I understand, it was far more intimate. This year, there was lots of press, and it was still like socially distanced screenings. So, you know, fewer seats and more sort of competition to actually get the tickets to see the films, and that made things a little bit more kind of anxiety driven than you'd like at a festival. But yeah, it was a weird one because all the sort of big American or English language Hollywood films were all sort of stacked at the top end because of Telluride, which happens over the first weekend, which is a kind of another big festival in America, which takes all these films that have played in Venice and rescreens them. But Venice has to have the world premiere, so they sort of end up just encasing them all in those first 3 days. So it's super intense. So the opening film was probably my favorite, which was the new Pedro Almodovar film, Parallel Mothers, which is, you know, it's him doing his thing, his kind of intricate, immaculate, amazing thing of like a melodrama that is about two women who have children at the same time and they're kind of intersecting lives. And one of the mothers is played by Penelope Cruz. And it's kind of a film that, I mean, I think a lot of his sort of more recent films have this element of like, he's got such a huge kind of canon of films now that, you know, you have this element of he's kind of referencing his older works and sort of almost not less referencing them, but like kind of bringing them back in and sort of riffing on those stories in new ways. And this one kind of feels like the sort of emerging of all the best of his films like Volver and All About My Mother and Talk to Her. And yeah, it's just incredible. I think Penelope Cruz, she had two films in the festival which were both great. Another one called Official Competition, which she plays a director, which you might have seen on Twitter that or social media, that she'd kind of, when she went to shoot the film, she held up a picture of the director Alma El Haral and said, "Make me look like this." And so she has these huge frizzy kind of ginger locks, and she's wearing like sequin cat suits and stuff like that. So but that one's a very, really funny film. That was that Official Competition, and Antonio Banderas in it with her. And yeah, it's like a really funny kind of filmmaking satire, and it's kind of bring the house down type of like cinema experience.
Yeah, talk us through some of these big English language movies then. You started off with Almodovar, but what else is playing there that stood out?
Yeah. So that was the Penelope axis. So yeah, I think probably weirdly the most sort of beloved was Dune by Denis Villeneuve, which is his huge sci-fi epic, which was on the cover of the recent Little White Lies magazine, which is out now for your delectation. And it was one of those films that I saw, and I was watching it and just thinking, wow, I really like this. It's really good. It's kind of got this sort of breathtaking epic scope. It's sort of doing some stuff that maybe we haven't seen in these movies before. It's kind of quite slow burn, and you know, there's kind of dramatic scenes that play out, and this is, you know, it's all based on this famous sci-fi novel from the 60s by Frank Herbert, and it's quite a kind of close adaptation of this quite huge book. So like, I think fans of the book are going to be very, very happy with this. But yeah, and it's got Timothée Chalamet in it as the kind of god king in waiting, Paul Atreides, and there are sandworms, and there are kind of helicopters that look like mosquitoes, and there's elbow fighting, and there's massive, huge vistas of deserts that kind of are sort of radiating in the dusk. And yeah, you've got it's kind of epic on all levels, really. And you've got this kind of quite subtle but really effective Hans Zimmer score as well. And it's, yeah, it, I was kind of like, my feeling was I really loved it, and I wasn't sure what anyone else was gonna take from it. Maybe they thought it was too slow, or, you know, because it ends halfway through the book, so you're kind of like, well, this is not a film, it's just a kind of prelude to something else. But it kind of gets by that, which when you see it, you'll know what I mean. But yeah, it's, and then the reviews, the embargo broke So you wait kind of 24 hours till you can post your reviews, and then it kind of, the floodgates open, and then it was just, yeah, this, everyone was hopped up on it, which was lovely to see, really, because it's offering something a bit different to the kind of whiz bang MCU type blockbuster.
Yeah, well, I'd really love to see, as someone who, you know, part of the big group of people who don't get to see it at a festival, who've been waiting so long for this because it's been one of those COVID delayed films, to hear that there is something exciting about it is all the better. So we mentioned Penelope Cruz earlier, who said was in two films. The person who really seemed to own the festival, run the table, you could say, is Oscar Isaac, both on screen and on the red carpet. Was he good?
I think Oscar Isaac is one of those people who, since Inside Llewyn Davis, he has, which I still think is like his best performance. He's been good in some quite, you know, mediocre films. And I think that this Venice leveled the tables a bit, where the films matched his charisma and his kind of level of performance. He's in Dune in a sort of smaller role, in which he's very good. And then, maybe the highlight for me was The Card Counter, which is the new Paul Schrader film, his follow up to First Reformed, which was a few years ago and was considered rightly a kind of major return to form for him. It's Schrader's usual thing about, you know, he's got this quote unquote God's lonely man who is struggling with existence in some sort of strange, very personal way. It's about he plays a character who has gone to prison for some reason that you find out later on, and while there he taught himself how to count cards, so he's kind of a poker whiz, and we join him as he's kind of just driving around America to these slightly seedy, crummy casinos and keeping his head down, winning decent amounts of money just to get himself by, but not going too big as to sort of spoil, like draw suspicion and make people sort of wear, you know, he doesn't want to be kind of blackballed from these places, which you can be for card counting. So, but then a kind of, he meets a guy played by Ty Sheridan, and they have a conversation, and then it suddenly unlocks this sort of dual narrative. Things get really exciting. It's a really kind of slick, purposeful, quite very stripped back, sometimes quite funny, but oftentimes quite, you know, it's a film that doesn't necessarily have like violence in it, but like there are implications of extreme violence that sort of sit outside the frame that kind of manage that sort of up the stakes of the drama. But yeah, it's a really great film. I think like First Reformed was brilliant, but maybe sat a bit more in the sort of art house realm, whereas this almost feels like someone said, oh, could you do First Reformed again, but make it a little bit more kind of genre-y, so it could play to a wider audience. And I mean, if that was the brief, Schrader's completely nailed it, because I mean, it's a, just on a very superficial level, I think this one's a more kind of fun film, if that term comes into play when you're dealing with this sort of subject matter, really.
So there are a handful of films there from sort of known quantities that we may have, you know, known the names of those filmmakers beforehand. It's good to know that those will likely come out on the horizon. Are there any sort of off the grid picks that you recommend us looking out for?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at time of recording, we haven't seen what the prizes are going to be. Bong Joon-ho is the jury president, and there's a lot of talk about what's Bong going to like. Oh, Bong's going to like this, Bong's going to like that. But I think he's a man of quite eclectic taste, so nobody really knows what he's going to go for. I think my two of my favorites in the competition were a bit more low key. One is called Il Buco by Italian filmmaker Michelangelo Framatino. He made a film in 2010 called La Quattro Volte, which was basically about goats. It was just shots of goats, but it was amazing. In that film, he kind of brought in these questions about what's being set up by the director, what's documentary, who knows where that line sits. And this new film is about a it's about a spelunking mission in the early 60s, in which a group of cavern divers drive off into the wilderness in Calabria, which is sort of southern Italy, and they descend into this abyss with just ropes and pretty much, yeah, some very bad lights on their helmets. And it's kind of a document of them discovering the third deepest cavern in the world. And it's got almost got a Werner Herzog vibe to it, because it's like, you know, he's actually gone down and he's filming in this place. And on one hand, you're kind of, wow, this is an amazing feat that's being filmed. But then you're kind of thinking, how the hell did they manage to do it? And there are stories about how he managed to film it, which are kind of mind blowing, really. Like, it's been 10 years since he's made his last film, and you think, well, maybe he spent quite a lot of it making this one, because it does not look like, you know, he set the bar high for himself. But yeah, I believe that one has been picked up and is going to be at the LFF, so definitely look out for that. Another one, which my final shout out goes to a film called L'Evenement, a French film by a first time filmmaker called Audrey Diwan, based on one of her memoir by Annie Ernaux, who has all those books released in English translation on Fitzcarraldo editions, those nice books with the white covers. And it's a kind of chronicle of her attempts in early, I think it's about 62, in sort of rural France. She's a student in a school, and she's got a bright future, and she wants to learn literature, and she's top of the class. She gets pregnant after the summer break, and her kind of knee jerk decision is, I want to get rid of the baby. And because abortion is illegal in France at that time, and it's illegal even if you help someone else get an abortion, which is, you know, considering what's happening in Texas now, it's very, very, very timely film. But yeah, it's just a very kind of unswerving, unsentimental chronicle of this girl's attempts to get an abortion, and basically the measures she has to take that are kind of not within the realms of legality, which the film kind of shows you. So you kind of, you know, you're seeing quite a lot of quite sort of hard hitting and intense material in the film, but that feels very kind of justified. It's not kind of gratuitous at all. It's like, you know, this is a film about showing the reality of the options that women have if they don't have reproductive health care available to them. And it's not really a political film, like in its intention, but obviously it's going to be one that's going to cause wide debate, I think, even though it's like, to me, seems like there isn't really an argument for the other side if you watch this film, but I'm sure there'll be people who have one. I don't believe it's been picked up yet at time of recording, but hopefully it will be. I'm hoping that it wins a prize. Maybe feels like it'll get like a jury prize or something. I think some people found it a bit heavy going for the big one, but on a final note, I would say that my tip for the big prize is probably Jane Campion's Power of the Dog. It's almost like, yeah, it's a kind of Western about toxic masculinity with Benedict Cumberbatch, and it's, I think, just as a piece of filmmaking, as a piece of craft, and the sort of detail that's gone into the recreation of, I think it's like 1910s rural Montana, it's set in this ranch, and the level of detail in the production design and the way it's filmed and the costumes and the dialogue is just kind of breathtaking. For me, the actual storyline didn't quite land entirely. It's extremely good film, and it's, you know, the kind of talent and the quality are very, very conspicuous, but like, yeah, it's just there was just something about its kind of, it has this very kind of tricksy second act which didn't quite land for me, but yeah, no, that's set to come out soon, and I would suspect it'd be interesting to see. I mean, another thing that happens at festivals that you get a lot of is people go and see films and they come out going, oh, Oscar mm-hmm. for her, oh, Oscar for him. There's lots of this kind of knee-jerk Oscar prognostication. And it's interesting because I thought that this would be an Oscar-y film, but I think maybe some people might think it's a little bit too subtle and slow burn for the Oscar set. But Campion definitely, at the very least, deserves Best Director.
Wow. Well, that's we'll have to wait and see in the short term for what wins all of the Lions. The Venice Film Festival, but then also Oscars next year. Also, it would be amazing to actually talk about these films when they do come out. I guess some of them will be on, you know, out almost immediately. Some of them may be one of those that come out in a year's time from a smaller distributor. But we can't wait to watch them. David, thank you for sharing your Venice highlights with us.
Thank you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thank you to David for sharing his highlights and his predictions for all things Venice Film Festival. Pamela, what was the food culture like in Lisboa? So David said it was very pizza heavy in Venice, of course.
Well, you know, there's nothing like sort of the slow, relaxed service of Lisbon cuisine, and therefore you don't get your dinner until you're already on the terrace watching the Sarah Muldaura films outside. And I had vegetarian lasagna and Sarah Muldaura's festival films, and that was my favourite bit of film culture.
That's the way to do it, isn't it? Yeah. Terrific. Okay, enough festival talk. We have new releases to discuss. Up first, we have Respect. Following the rise of Aretha Franklin's career from a young child singing in her father's church's choir to her international superstardom, Respect is the true story of the music icon's journey to find her voice and become the Queen of Soul. So, Rogan, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, I'd like to find out what it means to you. What did you make of this?
You know, I thought it was a pretty standard biopic. I thought, you know, I don't want that to sound like an insult. You know, it was the film that got Aretha Franklin's blessing. She requested Jennifer Hudson. She, you know, had, I guess, as much final say as she could before her death on how her story would be told. And I think the film reflects that. I think you see, a glimpse, or more than a glimpse, but you see the real hardship she went through early in her life. It's interesting, actually, because the film only covers the ages of 10 to 30. As we know, she lived into her 70s. So you see the real beginnings of her and sort of what made her. And it's a real Jennifer Hudson showcase. They're really gunning for that, for that nomination at least. It's pretty much what I expected. It's something that I feel like my mum would go and watch on a Sunday. And again, that's not an insult. I think that's what the film sets out to do, and it does it well. Yeah.
Well, Pamela, let's start with Jennifer Hudson then. There was some kerfuffle on social media around an out of context quote about how they almost flattered Aretha Franklin by having Jennifer Hudson in the role. We don't need to drag over that, but how is her impersonation? Does she compose herself well in this?
Well, Jennifer Hudson's always quite a joyful presence on film. She's a very sweet actress. I thought that there were times when her impersonation of Aretha Franklin, obviously, is so famous, you have to attempt an impersonation, was quite spot on. But I did feel that it wavered quite often. It's odd that she's playing a character who often doesn't say much about what she's thinking. And then when she does say something, it has quite a lot of import. There are a lot of scenes in this film of men, talking over Aretha Franklin. And then, of course, when Jennifer Hudson does come out with her sort of one compliment, you know, that bass line was rocking. You know, you really feel it. I think that Jennifer Hudson does a fantastic job because she's one of the few people who could even attempt to sing, to impersonate the vocals as well as performing the role. But I did think her performance wavered quite a bit. I was very impressed with the child actress who played her as a young girl. She was very sweet and very difficult role, the early life of Aretha Franklin, obviously. So that carried it through for me a little bit.
Rogan, do you agree about that? How was Hudson for you?
I do agree. I think that the film runs at like 2.5 hours. Long films aren't an enemy, but I did feel it. I did feel it. And I think somewhere in the middle, I did think to myself, this could have perhaps been a film about a struggling young woman in the music industry in the 60s. There are chunks of the film that don't necessarily feel like Aretha Franklin because they are sort of there to showcase how well Jennifer Hudson can sing. Really, you know, they really, you know, they perform the full songs at the piano. And it's interesting, yeah, I think she definitely wavered. The moments that she's spot on, she is spot on, but they do feel few and far between. But because she is such an enjoyable presence, you know, it may not matter to everyone. Yeah.
Gosh, 2.5 hours. Of course, this is a podcast, so I know I've not seen Respect. So I really did. I was mouth agape there at that. Does it deserve 2.5 hours, Pamela?
I think it's really interesting, Rogan's suggestion, actually, that you cut it down to a young woman in the 60s music industry, because that's the most interesting part of the film in many ways. I mean, you wouldn't want to be without Forest Whitaker playing her father, who's so fantastically ambivalent as a... But the most interesting parts of the film, for me, were about how Aretha Franklin did negotiate the 60s music industry and her creation of her music. I don't know about anyone else, but I'm still a mask wearer in the cinema, and I found my mask stretching as I grinned widely during the extended Respect sequence, where she sort of starts pootling along the piano, and then her sisters come in, and then suddenly she's at Madison Square Gardens, and you think, you know, maybe music hit its high point at this very moment. I mean, it's very strong on moments like that when you see her at work. And I think it feeds into there's a throwaway line in the film where one of her sisters calls her a genius. And there is a little bit about this film. It can feel quite conventional biopic-wise, but it's definitely got a mission, which is to give Aretha Franklin credit beyond being that famous singer that your parents like, you know. There's a big feminist spirit in this film. So yeah, maybe we could have done that. We could have centred on that and tried, rather than having to have the scenes of alcoholism and so on and extended bad husband moments.
We've spoken about a lot of music documentaries very recently on the show, quite a lot of really good, strong new releases. And that's always the question for me. I will watch music documentaries till the cows come home, but biopics I have trouble with, mainly for that reason, where they're so conventional or they often are too macrocosmic rather than focusing in on the interesting story. Of course, we had a great Aretha Franklin documentary, it was more of a performance film, Amazing Grace, that came out quite recently. Is there something here that we're not getting in that documentary that would put this in place of that, Rogan, Pamela?
No. I'm with you. I definitely prefer a music documentary over a biopic. But no, I mean, Amazing Grace is absolutely incredible. And this is, you know, a sort of Oscar contender paint by numbers, as I said. Yeah, I think definitely if you didn't know anything about her early life, and the like tremendous abuse she went through as a child, then, you know, you would come away learning something. But I think, no, I'm not sure it artistically or about Aretha, you know, it doesn't reveal anything, I would say, unique about her talent or genius in this film, no.
Of course, it does lead into Amazing Grace. So if you were to double bill, you might have a preference for the second half, but this film ends with the concert that was recorded in 1972 at the church in California that was Amazing Grace. So it would definitely wet your whistle for it. But yeah, no, that film is sort of spine tingling, and I'm afraid Respect is not spine tingling. It's a, you know, the most middlebrow genre of all, the biopic, and they do a nice job with it for the most part. There's always the awkward moments where they sort of get a phone call with bad news and so on. But one thing I did like, often with biopics, there's an awful lot of, oh, look, that's Elvis Presley kind of moments. And there's a really early scene in this film where the young Aretha Franklin is at a party and there are all these great musical names there. Mary J. Blige is fantastic, isn't she? But as a child, she looks really awestruck. So when she's saying, you know, hello, Auntie Ella, it's quite natural because she's as overwhelmed as a person might be. But yeah, generally, it falls into many of the pitfalls of the biopic. I highly recommend it for people on a Sunday afternoon who want to listen to Jennifer Hudson sing.
That sounds like quite an undertaking, Sunday afternoon double bill, this film, then Amazing Grace afterwards. That's going to be a good 4 hours of your time, I suppose. But let's put some scores on Respect. Rogan, I'll come to you first. This is In Anticipation, Enjoyment in Retrospect, out of 5.
I think I would give it a 3 across the board, honestly, because I don't think I would give it anything lower because it does what it says on the tin. Yeah, I wasn't really going in expecting anything, I don't know, boundary breaking, or, you know, and it does what it says on the tin, and it's perfectly fine if you were after another Aretha Franklin biopic. You know, I don't think you could go too wrong with this. So there you go.
Pamela?
This may be the most 3 out of 5 film of all time because it really earns those 3 points. You know, there's some great performances in here, obviously great music. It's very nicely done. Good to see Callie Corey writing, but no, yeah, it doesn't go any higher than a 3 for me. And 3 out of 5 ain't bad.
I'm sure, yeah, never true words spoken. Okay, that was Respect. Up next, we're going to a film that premiered at the Berlin Film Festival earlier this year, Co-Pilot. When sharp science student Asli meets charismatic Saeed in the mid-90s, it's love at first sight. The lovers marry, and Asli swears to be true to Saeed and never betray his secrets. Their future looks bright, but as the 21st century dawns, Saeed makes a decision that will not only shatter Asli's dreams, but shake the whole world to the core. Pamela, I suppose to start with on this film, it does have something that, you know, there is a context to this film, that if this were a Marvel movie, it could be classed as a spoiler, but of course it's a festival movie, so this is important context we should discuss. So could you please introduce us a bit to what Co-Pilot is doing, what that context is, please?
So Co-Pilot is a rip from the headlines film, absolutely. It's based on something that happened in real life, but then it fictionalises a lot of that. And I wouldn't really want anyone to go into this film not knowing where it's leading, because it's quite upsetting, obviously. It's a 9/11 film in some ways. It's about one of the young men who was involved in the 9/11 attack, and it's about his wife. And I think it's interesting to me because often with attacks like this, there was a lot of prurient headlines around the widows afterwards. You know, how much did they know? I think people are looking for someone to blame. This film sort of promises to explore what it would be like to be that woman, but it's definitely trying to suggest that there's a lot of innocence involved, and that the, you know, trying to sort of say, no, it was just a romance like any other. It wasn't quite a romance like any other, I think. So there are people that will be opposed to this film from the outset, or wary of this film from the outset. For the most part, it's a very sweet, sort of naturalistic romance, sort of Romeo and Juliet, because her mother disapproves of the marriage vibe, you know, handheld camera work, lots of people standing up in cars and splashing around in the lake. And there's a lot of sweetness to the film, which then might feel a little bit sour when you get to the end, I think.
Yeah, so it actually puts it more maybe in a similar genre, maybe to these true crime films we've had recently, like Charlie Says, about the women that are part of Charles Manson's family, and then also the film that the Zac Efron film with a very long title that I can't remember.
Violin something cruel of something
which again was looking at the sort of women in the context, because yeah, that's sort of a part of true crime. Rogan, what did you make of that aspect of it? Is it doing something, anything interesting here with that?
No, I mean, I think there is potential there for a really interesting film about you know the gradual radicalization of a young man and how, you know, his wife deals with that or turns a blind eye or doesn't cope. You know, that would be an interesting story to watch. It's, the film sort of jumps. It's like year one and you see what happens, and then year two, and it goes, I think, five, six mm-hmm. years it goes across. And like, you know, there's a lot of potential in the film, and I think the performances are great. But yeah, the 9/11 of it all does really sour it and really sort of cheapens it, I think. And I'm not sure, I don't know why it was made, because it doesn't really offer anything interesting. You know, I think there is something to sort of think about or try and uncover when it comes to young men being radicalized and the people and their families that they leave behind and so on. But it kind of doesn't really do that. It is this sort of star-crossed lovers thing right up until the end. And you go, and you know, there are hints of his radicalization throughout, but it's not, again, I think it's secondary to the romance, and I'm not really sure why that is when it's based on, well, yeah, when it's about 9/11, I suppose.
Mm. There is a sort of trick shot at the end, and that's when you're sort of really invited to think about what the name co-pilot means and the complicitness of this young woman. But as Rogan says, you know, I think that we're all interested, concerned, fascinated, whatever the word might be, about how people do get radicalised in this way. And this film has that as its subplot. That's the bit you don't see. So it's almost as if, like, you know, if you marry someone, inevitably they might get radicalised. It's not sort of suggesting how that happens. And as the synopsis points out, she's a phenomenally intelligent woman. She's a medical student. You see a lot of time with her cadaver, which was an interesting choice on behalf of the filmmaker. You know, so you do think she's got something to say. She would have something to say about this if he were discussing his ideas with her, whether she's sort of mostly in the position of sort of defending him in family arguments.
It is almost like it has that, the film upside down. As you say, The part that is most fascinating to us as a culture is the subplot. And what is the main plot is the great unknowability of that you have. You may be fully in love with someone, maybe married to them. You may take these vows about sharing everything, guarding their secrets. There's a moment early on which very much hits that nail on the head about that being part of their marriage vows, is keeping each other's secrets. But then that it feels like it pulls its punches, you know, narratively, thematically, as it goes. There are some interesting parts in it. I think the performances are great. There's one bit where it's to show the bit where, in retrospect, it's when he's playing the role of a, you know, sun-kissed, top-down Florida man. They're speeding along to Third Eye Blind's Kryptonite. Absolute landfill 90s rock tune.
The opening sequence at the fun fair, I can't remember the name of the song, but it's one about my lover's got no money, but he's got his strong beliefs, which somehow turns your stomach at the end of the film a little bit. It's a bit, definitely some 90s nostalgia there, perhaps, for some of us. There's interesting things, and you are invited to feel sort of sorry for her, because they do talk about the family they want to have and things like this, and obviously she's lost something. But I think the filmmakers knew going in that they were dealing with something that was complicated and controversial. Looking at the filmmaker, the director, she's also made film about abortion and things like this. So maybe she's not looking for us to feel better about ourselves or feel like we learned something. Maybe she's looking to make us examine something rather unpleasant. But she also sort of gives us this really romantic, youthful romance as well. So it's hard to understand.
And it is something at the end when that complicity is brought to the foreground, that sense that behind every great man is a woman, or, you know, that old adage, you know, whether you believe it or not, that feeling that she unwittingly has been his support all the way through, and he calls her his co-pilot, is quite chilling. I can see in these kernel moments throughout the really profound film that's within, but there's perhaps something missing for me as the film goes on. Should we put some scores on this? Pamela, I'll come to you first.
So, in anticipation, mm-hmm. two. And at times when I was watching it, it almost was a four, but it's down to a three. Just because I thought that this is beautiful filmmaking, and I'm left in a torment. Maybe I'll come to terms with it in 6 months.
Rogan?
I would say three. I think I always try to go in and think, you know, hopefully it's at least the middle ground. And then I would say, yeah, I'd say almost a four as well. Watching it, I flip between, sort of that three, four. There are some really great moments, and I can't kind of decide if I feel like the sort of terrorism subplot was maybe a cop-out, or, you know, not exploring it, sorry, or having it as a subplot was a cop-out, because there's a really great love story there. Again, the performances are great. And then I guess, two or three in retrospect. I wouldn't rush to watch it again or to recommend it, but it's not a terrible waste of time. Way to spend your time, sorry.
This woman's got a really interesting film in her.
I will say that performances, you know, those actors were fantastic. The filmmaker, will seek out their name again in festivals to come. We haven't had a new release week like this for a while, because major studios have had their backlog of COVID delayed films. So there's always a major movie, the must see movie of the week. This week we have, a respected festival film and a sort of middling film as well, which you're both giving sort of threes, fours to. Which would you recommend? Pamela, I'll come to you first, and then Rogan. Which would you recommend out of these two? If you could see one at the cinema this weekend.
Gosh, if you had to see one at the cinema this weekend, only because someone would come and knock on my door and be angry with me if I recommended Co-Pilot, even though it's probably better, I'd say Respect. But there is another film out this week.
Yeah, hold that thought. But Rogan, out of the two new releases,
I think I would say Respect as well. I would say Respect.
But yes, as Pamela said, there is another film in cinemas this week. It just doesn't happen to be a brand spanking new one, but it is in a brand new restoration. It is Joseph Losey's The Servant. Tony was rich, indolent, charming, and a little stupid. He wanted a manservant to do everything for him, but he was too indolent, too charming, and a little too stupid to see that Barrett was bogus to the core. And Barrett, day by day, grew less servile and more indispensable. With elegant savagery, The Servant explores the relationship between the servant and his golden young victim. Wow, that's a full tilt synopsis if there ever was one. So, Pamela, this is an absolute classic of British cinema, always in lists and so on. So many roots into this, stars, the writer, filmmakers. Where should we start with The Servant?
Start by knowing that this film is from 1963, and it's about the British establishment collapsing in on itself in the most savage and brutal way. There are, like, snakes, there's corruption, there's mould, everything's falling apart. It's really, I think the easiest way is in through the character of The Servant, which is played by Dirk Bogarde. And if you want to know something about great British film history, Dirk Bogarde started out as a matinee idol. He was the doctor who was always in love, you know, and then in the 60s he started getting weird. And so he made Victim with Joseph Losey, who also directed this, the American director, where he played a gay barrister. And then he played The Servant. And by the time the 70s roll around, he's in sick, twisted European arthouse films like The Night Porter and Death in Venice. So this is his halfway house, and halfway house to full-on sickness and corruption, and it's pretty, pretty vile. It's a great film.
It really is. So much to talk about. Rogan, what did you make of this? Had you seen this before? Was this a first view for you?
This is a first watch for me, and now I'm excited to watch more Joseph Losey, because he's someone, my friend actually told me about this film like 2 years ago. He's like, you have to watch this. And so I've had it in my head, and then I was like, okay, brilliant excuse. It's wonderful. It's brilliant. It's beautifully shot. The story is great. It gets under your skin. It's quite dirty in some way, but also incredibly beautiful to watch. It's it is brilliant, and I'm excited to explore more of Dirk Bogarde and Losi. Yeah, I'm very happy. It's like opened up a new world.
I'm glad you mentioned the cinematography, because that's something that we can always, you know, revisit or see for the first time in, you know, popping 4K restorations like this. Because, and it's Douglas Slocum, who, you know, in one of the funniest career trajectories of all time, 20, 30 years after this, became Steven Spielberg's cinematographer for Indiana Jones. And I think it's actually there's an amazing sense of space and camera movement within this very claustrophobic townhouse, and also the moves between the way the frame is used and depth of focus to placement of characters in the space is, you know, you can see that Steven Spielberg could be inspired by something like this, even though the style of the film couldn't be more different from what he makes.
It's all mirrors and stairs. Every time you can't get away from F1. The house was actually made bigger than a townhouse would be, and yet it feels smaller. It's like being locked in the Phantom Thread house. It's really disturbing home, and the shadows formed by that staircase particularly vile. Yeah, sorry.
No, it's really wonderful. And also Harold Pinter writing the screenplay, starting an amazing run of screenplays he would write in the 60s and 70s. But I'd love how his stage plays would be all about power dynamics through dialogue. And that is also matched by Losi and Slocum also using cinematography and blocking to also get across power dynamics as they shift. And the film that you think you're going to see is almost played out in the first hour of this, where Barrett takes Tony for a ride and brings in Vera, who is posing as his sister but is actually his lover, and then they're cast out. But then there's a very strange 45 minutes after that where it just keeps getting more and more twisted and surreal and subversive. Pamela, I'd like to talk about James Fox for a second, and what's his legacy that isn't his son, who we shouldn't talk about?
No, let's only be careful which Foxes we discuss. So James Fox was actually dating Sarah Miles, I think, who plays Vera, which is a freaky coincidence when you watch the film at some point. So he was really brought in for this, and, you know, he's this very tall, blonde, handsome actor who's almost too proper to live. And then, you know, so he had a bit of a career. Then he made Performance. Now, if you want to see a house in which two polar opposite people go mad in a West London townhouse, and you've seen The Servant, you have to watch The Performance, which has got him and Mick Jagger, you know, and they're a gangster and a rock star, which I think was so disturbing for James Fox to make that he then didn't make another film for a long time. So he has this incredibly powerful career that basically defines 1960s British cinema. And yeah, he is wonderful in this. He is the son of Empire, the idiot, as you point out so well in your synopsis. And he's rather sweet in his naivety. There is almost a moment or two where you want him to sort of beat Barrett, where you want him to get out of it unscathed. But there's no stopping the rise of the working classes. I'm so sorry. It's the 1960s after all.
but you know, we were talking about Co-Pilot just then, about, you know, complex politics or themes, and similarly with respect, films that sort of maybe give a simpler view than the complex view. This is a very slippery film to get your handle on. It's not as simple as The Working Class Rising Up. But by the end, it's gone full Dolce Vita, and it's all about excess and indulgence, and no one seems happy.
No, you know, and you sort of have to, you know, it'd be great to read about this film, read about the Profumo affair, read about the Lady Chatterley trial, read about all these kind of things, miniskirts, you know, but also the film itself is complex psychological warfare. You know, and it works on that level. There's no way you would believe the film is going to go exactly where it goes at the beginning. I don't know how you felt about that, Rogan. I mean, obviously you're watching it for the first time.
No, I agree. I didn't really know where it was going. And one thing I found really interesting is there's no kind of reason for, you know, there's no rationale. It's like he's doing this because he has, you know, really strong moral convictions, you know, and he's, you know, there's no indication that he is, you know, I am going to rise up as the working class. He just does it. And I really like that, because sometimes rich idiots should be punished, and it was just really nice to see, you know, it was just nice. I like that aspect of it, the lack of explanation and just the psychological warfare and just because and the way it moved, it was wonderful.
Yeah, because Tony's not really the establishment, is he? He sort of just bought this house. It's falling apart. You know, he isn't really all he pretends to be. So he's phony, and he sort of should be brought down. You know, he doesn't even know what he wants from a manservant. What kind of gentleman is he? What's it? The great line: "I'm a gentleman's gentleman, and you're no gentleman."
That's a great line. It's always whenever we talk about these restorations and re-releases, sometimes it can be tinged with a sense of something we've lost, that we don't see films like this again. But actually, watching The Servant again for the first time in a decade or whatever, it reminded me quite strongly, both in the sense of this phony at the centre, this directionless ambition, and also the fact that it's this mouldy old British house that does not look nice to live in at all. Remind me of The Nest, the Sean Durkin's film that only came out a couple of weeks ago, has a similar sort of creeping tension and rot at the core of British society, and it'd be wonderful to see those two side by side. I don't know if either of you have watched that film yet.
No, I haven't seen that one yet. I mean, I was watching it and I thought, oh, this is going to be like Parasite. It's not. You can definitely draw some like surface level comparisons, but no, it isn't quite like Parasite. Maybe a bit more talented Mr. Ripley almost. But still, no, definitely its own thing, its own wonderful thing. Yeah.
So, Rogan, would you wish to go deeper into this after watching The Servant?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah,
I think I'd echo Pamela's recommendation of Performance. That's another. So it's almost like this is pre-Beatlemania and Performance is post-Beatlemania, and looking at almost similar things from two different angles.
Yeah, or watch Accident, which is Joseph Losey and Dirk Bogard again, Pinter, and Bogard plays a sort of sleazy Oxford don, and that really is all about sexual harassment, basically, and the corruption at the heart of the British establishment, which is an endless theme. That's a great one.
The well's deep on that one. You can, yeah.
It never runs out.
Yeah, no, but brilliant. Thank you. I'll check those out, absolutely.
And let us know what you make of it if you do watch any of those films. And listeners, let us know too if you've watched either the new releases this week or The Servant. Maybe it's a revisit, maybe it's a first watch. Let us know what you think at the usual channels, at LWLies on Twitter, Truth and Movies at tcolondon.com via email. Pamela Rogan, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for joining me this week. Next week, everybody's talking about Jamie, and so are we. We're also reviewing Rose Plays Julie, and since it's 20 years since the release of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, we're going to revisit that in Film Club 2. Listeners, please subscribe wherever you pod, and if your podcast player of choice lets you leave reviews, we'd love you to leave one for us too. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.